This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin a week-long series featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. We begin with Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones guitarist. He published his autobiography in October. It's called Life, and it's filled with details about excess and drugs, but it's also filled with stories about growing up in post-World War II England. He was born in 1943. Discovering the blues, songwriting, forming the Rolling Stones, being targeted by police in the U.S. and the U.K., who saw the Stones as a bad influence on youth, becoming megastars, playing stadiums, kicking heroin, his sometimes rocky relationship with Mick Jagger, getting older, and so on. Richards co-wrote much of the Stones' repertoire with Jagger, including Satisfaction, Let's Spend the Night Together, Get Off My Cloud, Gimme Shelter, Sympathy for the Devil, and Beast of Burden. I spoke with Keith Richards in late October. You have a great story in your book about how you co-wrote, well, how you got Satisfaction started. You co-wrote the song with Mick Jagger, but you originated it, and you didn't know you were doing it. Can you?
I wish all the songs could come this way, you know, but you just dream of them, and then the next morning, there they are, presented to you. But Satisfaction was that sort of miracle that took place. I had one of the first little cassette players, you know, Norelco, whatever, you know, Philips, the same thing, really. But it was a fascinating little machine to me, a cassette player, that you could actually just lay ideas down and, you know, wherever you were. I set the machine up and I put in a fresh tape. I go to bed as usual with my guitar and I wake up the next morning, I see that the tape has run to the very end. And I think, well, I didn't do anything. You know? I said, maybe I hit a button while I was asleep, you know. So I put it back to the beginning and push play. And there, in some sort of ghostly version, is... I can't get no satisfaction. And so there's a whole verse of it. I won't bore you with it all. And after that, there's, I don't know, 40 minutes of me snoring. but there's the song and its embryo, and I actually dreamt the damn thing, you know what I mean? And I'm still waiting for another dream.
Now, how did the line, I can't get no satisfaction, come to you at a time when you should have been having a lot of very satisfying, gratifying moments?
Darling, I don't know. I dreamt it.
No, true. Okay.
I mean, nobody's ever satisfied, right? And it was just a phrase that obviously, you know, was buzzing through the mind. And whether you could express anything or enlarge on that idea. Because otherwise I can't get any satisfaction. It's kind of, you know, sort of moaning. But if you then you can take it and expand it, and which Mick did brilliantly. There it is. I mean, these things are all made out of just little sparks of ideas that come to you, and you're lucky to be around to grab them. And that's kind of basically the process of how we work.
Okay, so let's hear Satisfaction. This is the Rolling Stones. My guest is Keith Richards, and he's written a new autobiography called Life.
I tried.
That's the Rolling Stones, and my guest is Keith Richards, and he's written his autobiography. It's called Life. Now, that cassette that you mentioned that you used to write down the idea for Satisfaction in the middle of the night, that so surprised you when you played it back in the morning, that cassette or one just like it was also really helpful to you in coming up with a kind of transformative guitar sound. Would you describe how you would plug your acoustic guitar in motel rooms into
a cassette machine? That's a good question. I'll try. Because there I am, I now have my hands on the best amplifiers in the world and the best guitars. But I'm trying to translate another sound in my head that I can't find through conventional means. I always play a lot of acoustic guitar. And the cassette machine gave it, in those days, before they had things on them called governors, which means that you could not overload the machinery, I would just shove the acoustic guitar and use, basically, I would use the cassette player as an amplifier, basically, and overload the acoustic guitar so it becomes an electric guitar. But at the same time, you see, you still have that feel of an acoustic, which is totally different to an electric. So I'm still looking for the perfect example of this, but I'm going to keep going.
So what you would get is like an electrified acoustic guitar that was also distorted.
Exactly. You got it, Terry. You got it. That's it. I was trying to get the quality and the touch that you can get from an acoustic guitar and then overload it and make it sound like an electric guitar. But at the same time, you have that original acoustic touch because... You know, this gets complicated because guitars are strange animals. but there's a touch that you can get off an acoustic guitar that you'll never get off an electric. And so I was trying to figure how to electrify the acoustic feel and still translate it. And so that was the name of the game. That was it.
Now, it was surprising enough to me to read how you did this in your motel room, but then reading how you did it also in the recording studio was fascinating, that you wanted that sound so much that you brought in the cassette machine and plugged your acoustic guitar into it.
Yes, I mean, I took these ideas and we, the Stones were in the studio, and we were all looking at it and saying, it doesn't have what you had on the, on the original idea. And so finally, after many attempts to try and reproduce this sort of idea, with amplifiers and, conventionally, I think it was Charlie Watts maybe, let's go back to how you did it in the first place and work it from there, which is why you got Street Fighting Man and Jumping Jack Flashes. There are no electric guitars at all. It's just overloaded acoustics. I don't know, I like that denseness of color, of feel, that you can get out of that. And it's an experiment I might take up again once they start making cassette machines again.
So do you think Jumpin' Jack Flash is a good illustration of what you're doing?
Yeah, and Street Fighting Man is probably another great example of it.
Which one would you rather hear?
I love them both, honey. Don't ask me to cut the babies in half.
All right, so we'll go with Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Go there. All right,
So here's the Rolling Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and my guest Keith Richards playing the kind of plugged into the cassette machine guitar that he was just describing. And he has an autobiography called Life.
I
the Rolling Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash. My guest is Keith Richards, and he has a new autobiography, which is called Life. Then there are the songs that you describe as anti-girl songs that the Stones did, like Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, Yesterday's Papers. And this is where I've been so ambivalent about some of the Stones songs, like Under My Thumb. Under My Thumb is so catchy. I mean, I think it's just like irresistible what's going on, like melodically and rhythmically in there. And then, you know, I catch myself singing along, and what am I singing, you know, like about this girl who's like, you know, under his thumb. And so, anyways, were you ever ambivalent about that?
Let me try and break in here.
Go ahead.
Terry,
let me break in here
and say, you can take it as, you know, male, female, or it's just people. I mean, it could be about a guy. It could have been, you know, this is just a guy thing, you know, that probably you're actually under her thumb and you're just trying to fight back, you know. I mean, these are all the relationships and stuff, and I wouldn't take it as any, like, sexism. I can't even go there, you know, but I don't think about it. I just think, you know, we know what some people are like, and those things happen. Anyway, I didn't write the lyrics.
Cut to the chase. Off the hook. All right. We're listening back to the interview I recorded with Keith Richards. His autobiography is called Life. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's talk just a little bit about Altamont, which was the music festival in which at the Altamont Raceway in California, which one man was stabbed to death and three others died accidentally. This was a free concert, and you describe how you'd asked the Grateful Dead, by you I mean the Rolling Stones, had asked the Grateful Dead to help organize it because they had a lot of experience with free concerts. And the permits that you'd expected to get for Golden Gate Park and another place or two fell through, and by that time Altamont was the only place available. So when you were on stage there, at what point did you know things were really taking a bad turn and that this wasn't like a Woodstock concert? There was some really nasty things happening in the audience.
There was the potential for nasty things, and nasty things did happen. From my point of view, I was amazed that that was all that happened. Meredith, who went down in this thing,
the man who was killed, stabbed to death.
Yes, the man who was killed. He was asking for trouble, and you have the Hell's Angels there. Basically, from my point of view, I'd say I realized this thing was getting dodgy just by looking at the Angels.
Who were hired to do the security? I think I might have neglected
to mention like, that. The Grateful Dead's guys, and they've said, oh, no problem, you know, these guys, we work with them, and blah, blah. And they said, okay, we just want to know how to do. We just want to throw a free one, you know. Also, a unique time for America, 1969. There were no cops around. It was like, just go off and do what you want to do, you know. They didn't, and there was no control. And it was a very, very weird feeling in the middle of nowhere. You know, Altamont is basically, you know, Mars. And there was nobody else to turn to except who? The Hell's Angels. I'm not going to turn to them. They're all on acid. And Thunderbird wine. And I think we did actually an incredible job. If you look at the whole video of it, or the footage of it, that didn't get out of hand, because there was that point where it could have really got out of hand. And I think by just saying, stop it, we ain't going to play, somehow there was a check there, and we managed to prevent a much larger disaster. And but you've got to wing these things. You don't know what's going to happen, you know.
Did you decide at that point what would be the best song to play to quiet things down as opposed to amp things up?
Well, I don't know about whether it was the right song to play, but I think we went into Sympathy for the Devil.
That's what
but,
I thought, yeah.
Yeah, but I think we just wanted something with a rhythm. It didn't really, by then, nobody could hear what anybody was singing or saying or anything. It was just like, hey, you know when there's a fight in a bar room and the band stops and then some stuff goes down and they're like, play some music, whatever it is. We don't give a damn. Just play, divert attention and try and get people into a pulse, So whatever it was, we chose the samba.
Is there anything you wish you had done differently?
That's a good call, and it's very hard to pick out. No, there's nothing I'd have done differently. I'd have had to, how do you deal with things that are just snapping at you straight out the face and you're on the line? I can't think of anything where I said, I wish I'd done that or I should have done that.
Mm-hmm. In describing your approach to songwriting, you talk about vowel movements. That's vowel with a V, as in A-E-I-O-U.
That was with Warren Zevon. That was, yes, my conversation with Warren.
And explain what a vowel movement is.
Well, a vowel, you know what vowels are, right?
Yes.
I mean, there's the oohs and the e's and the r's and the a, without the consonants. And it's where they come sometimes in a record that will either make or break a record. It was about choosing the right sound at the right time to put the right oo or ah, and whether a word should contain that vowel or not. Warren Zevon said to me, he says, damn it, he says, my problem is consonants. You know what I mean? This is a songwriting thing, you know.
But you actually use, oos and ahs in some of the writing.
Think about them and whether they're in the right place. Yeah, I mean, you if you're a songwriter, you've got to think about things like that. I mean, the wrong sounding vowel in the wrong place can ruin a good record.
Now, is Beast of Burden a good example of that? Like in the bridge, in the Am I Rough Enough? Ooh, the oohs there in that bridge?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's we worked an awful lot on where to put the oohs and the ahs. You got to laugh about this because when you're tearing to bits what it is you actually do, it's kind of weird, right? And, it's very important whether you go E, oo, ah, oo, bam, etc. When you're making a record, because the wrong vowels in the wrong places might trip everything up. So you concentrate on everything when you're writing a song or making a record. It's sometimes probably you concentrate too much. But at the same time, I concentrate on vowel movement.
So I'm going to play Beast of Burden. Do you want to say anything about writing it or what you're playing on it?
No, I loved it. It's another one that came very natural. Sitting around with Mick, here's one. And Mick, see, I write songs for Mick to sing. That's what I do. I mean, you don't get Midnight Ramblers out of nowhere. You don't get Gimme Shelters out of nowhere. I'm writing because I say, man, I know this guy can handle this and nobody will ever be able to handle it any other way. What I do is write songs for Mick to sing. And if he picks up on it, baby, we got. If he doesn't, I'll just let it sit on the shelf.
What are the qualities in his voice and in his personality that you feel you're writing for?
He's an outstanding performer. Hey, you're talking about a mixture of James Brown and Maria Callas here. I gotcha.
That's good.
Yeah. And to have to work with such an outsized personality, ego, and say, hey, whatever it takes, it's there, and you gotta go for it. And sometimes it doesn't work, and a lot of times it does, and so you just keep on pushing.
My interview with Keith Richards was recorded last October after the publication of his autobiography, Life. Our series featuring some of the most entertaining interviews of the year continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Beast of Burden.
NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone.
That's the band Queen. Brian May is a founding member of Queen and its lead guitarist. In recent years, he's been concerned with a different kind of dust. 3 years ago, he submitted his doctoral thesis in astrophysics on the subject A Survey of Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud. He's now Dr. May, and he's Chancellor of Liverpool John Moores University. But that's not the only twist in his career that would surprise Queen fans. Brian May recently co-wrote the book A Village Lost and Found that features stereoscopic photos from the 1850s. In August, I spoke with May about Queen and its lead singer Freddie Mercury, who died in 1991. Brian May wrote one of the band's biggest hits, We Will Rock You.
Your big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, we will rock you. We will rock you. Buddy, you're a young man, hard man, shouting in the street, gonna take on the world someday. You got blood on your face, your big disgrace, waving your banner all over the place.
That's Queen's We Will Rock You, which is written by my guest, Brian May, who was the lead guitarist for the band. So what inspired that song? I mean, it's been played at so many sports stadiums over the decades. Were you thinking of it as a sports anthem? Because it almost sounds like an old-school cheerleader cheer, you know,
yeah,
because of that stomp-stomp clap thing. Mm-hmm. And because it's a chant.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the stomp-stomp clap thing, yeah, people think it was always there, but actually it wasn't. And I don't know how it got into my head. All I can tell you is we played a gig sort of middle of our career in a place called Bingley Hall near Birmingham. Now, Birmingham is the sort of home of heavy metal, as you probably know. You know, Sabbath and Slade and people come from there. And it was a great night. People just, the audience were just responding hugely. And they were singing along with everything we did. Now, in the beginning, we didn't relate to that. We were the kind of band who liked to be listened to and taken seriously and all that stuff, you know. So people singing along wasn't part of our agenda. Having said that, and then having experienced this wave of participation of the audience, in particularly in that gig in Birmingham, we almost to a man sort of reassessed our situation. I remember talking to Freddie about it and saying, look, you know, obviously we can no longer fight this. This has to become something which is part of our show, and we have to embrace it, and the fact that people want to participate, and really everything becomes a two-way process now. And we sort of looked at each other and went, how interesting. And he went away that night and, to the best of my knowledge, wrote We Are the Champions with that in mind. I went away and woke up the next morning with this in my mind somehow, because I was thinking to myself, what could you give an audience that they could do while they're standing there and they're all crushed together? They can stamp and they can clap and they can sing some kind of chant. So for some reason, it just came straight into my head that We Will Rock You. And to me, it was a kind of uniting thing. It was an expression of strength.
So how did you record the stomp, stomp, clap so it would sound grand and reverberating as opposed to four people mm-hmm. stomping their feet and clapping?
Well, I'm a physicist, you see. So I had this idea, if we did it enough times and we didn't use any reverb or anything, that I could build a sound which would work. We were very lucky. We were working in an old disused church in North London, and it already had a nice sound. Not an echoey sound, but a nice big crisp sound to it. And there were some old boards lying around. I don't know what they were, but they just seemed ideal to stamp on. So we kind of piled them up and started stamping. And they sounded great anyway. But being a physicist, I thought, well, supposing there were 1,000 people doing this, what would be happening? And I thought, well, you would be hearing them stamping. You would also be hearing a little bit of an effect which is due to the distance that they are from you. So I put lots of individual repeats on them, not an echo, but a single repeat, and at varying distances. And the distances were all prime numbers. Now, much later on, people designed a machine to do this, and I think it was called Prime Time or something. But that's what we did. As we recorded each track, we put a delay of a certain length on it, and none of the delays were sort of harmonically related. So what you get is there's no echo on it whatsoever, but the claps sound as though they're spread around the stereo, but they're also kind of spread as regards distance from you. So you just feel like you're in the middle of a large number of people stamping on boards and clapping.
That's amazing.
And also singing.
Now, here's another really interesting thing to me about We Will Rock You. It's the most famous song that you've written. It's a largely a cappella song. You come in for your guitar solo at the very end. So until like the very, very end, like you're not even playing on it. And it's just kind of amazing that you as the guitarist would write a song that you're barely featured on.
Well, I'm featured stamping and clapping.
Well, yes.
And I'm featured singing.
And you're very good at that.
Thank you, yeah. Well, we're all featured, yeah. The guitar solo, yeah, I didn't want it to be standard. I didn't want it to be like, oh, here's a guitar solo, and then we sing another verse. I wanted it to be something stark and different. So it was very deliberate that I left the guitar solo to the end. Because that was a final statement and a different statement, taking it off in a completely different direction. It changes key into that piece too, you know. So it's a whole different kind of shift. It was not a standard pop song.
Okay, so let's just hear the end of We Will Rock You, and we'll hear that guitar solo.
Okay.
Here it is. So that's the end of We Will Rock You, written by my guest, guitarist and singer and songwriter Brian May, who was one of the founding members of Queen. So,
Can I comment on the end of that?
Yeah, please.
Interesting that you play the end of the song. You can hear the guitar waiting in the wings. You can hear this little feedback note. And so the guitar is present, although it's not taking center stage all through the last choruses. And then finally it bursts upon the scene. And you notice Freddie goes, all right, which means he's kind of handing over to the guitar. And we're in a different universe once the guitar starts. And that was the intention. And it's very sort of informal. And you may notice, there's a lot of things to notice. You may notice that the last piece the very last little riffs are repeated, and they're not just repeated by me playing them again, they're repeated by cutting the tape and splicing it on again and again. So, and that's deliberate too. It's a way of getting a sort of a thing that makes you sit up towards the end. And then it stops. There is nothing after it, which I really enjoy. There's no big ending. It just stops and leaves you in midair thinking, well, what happened there?
My guest is Brian May, a co-founder and the lead guitarist of the band Queen. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian May, a co-founder of the band Queen and its lead guitarist. The lead singer, Freddie Mercury, died in 1991. Mercury was very theatrical in his performances and songwriting. One of the most theatrical and unconventional songs Mercury wrote for Queen was Bohemian Rhapsody. How did he demo the song for you before the band started performing it?
He sat down at the piano and he said, and here's a bit where everything stops and there's an a cappella bit and then we come back in again. He had it all mapped out, and that's the way it was done. The backing track was piano, bass and drums, and I was sitting in the studio and it sounded great. It sounded intriguing and crisp and lively and challenging. And then as the days went on and the weeks went on, we started overdubbing all the different vocal parts. And as you probably know, you know, there's many of us on there. We would do each part a number of times until it was right and then go to another part and multi-track everything. In those days, you're working on 24-track tapes, so you run out of tracks quite quickly. So when you've put down, say, half a dozen tracks, you have to bounce them. You have to combine them into one track and then move on, which is a dicey process because you're losing information at that point. You're also losing generations. And we did it so often on Bohemian Rhapsody that the legend says, and it's true, that the tape wore out. We suddenly realized we were losing top on the vocals. They were getting a bit dull. And we held the tape up to the light and you could see through it. So there was hardly any oxide left on it. So at that point, we swiftly had to make a copy and carry on. So it was a very different way of recording to the way you would do it now because there was no going back.
Now, you mentioned that this started as, you know, piano and then piano, bass and drums, but you do have a guitar solo, a very well-known one.
Oh, yeah, well, that's
one.
Added after, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
and course, yeah. And it kind of bridges two sections of the song. So here's Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody with my guest Brian May on guitar and also doing some of the voices.
Will you do the fandango? Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo, Galileo
Figaro.
Magnifico! I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah!
No, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
So that's Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody with featuring my guest Brian May on guitar. Could you explain to me what the Mamma Mia Galileo Scaramouche part is about?
No.
Uh-huh,
of course not.
Could Freddie Mercury have explained it to you?
Because I didn't write it. You should have asked Freddie. Ah, well, you'd have had to ask him, wouldn't you? Yeah, I would never ask him.
Why wouldn't you have asked him, what am I singing about? Why am I singing this?
You know, it's a funny thing. I think about it quite a lot. We never discussed what our songs meant. It was a sort of unwritten law that there was something in the songs which was very personal. And if somebody brought it in, you wouldn't get into it. You would just assume that they knew what they were doing. And it's odd, isn't it? I mean, later on it changed. I remember starting to write The Show Must Go On. And Freddie came and sat down beside me, and I said, look, I want you to participate. I want us to do this together. And we absolutely discussed every single word and what it meant and what we were trying to do. But in the early days, it never, ever happened. We just assumed that the writer of the song knew what he was doing.
So let me just play you one thing that I'm sure you're familiar with. Here it comes.
I think we'll go with a little Bohemian Rhapsody, gentlemen.
Good call.
The delightful Wayne's World.
Yes, Mike Myers from the movie Wayne's World.
I have to thank Mike Myers for introducing us to a whole new generation at that time. It was amazing what it did.
What did it do for Queen?
Oh, it completely translated us to the new generation. And Freddie was already not well by that time, but I took it round to him. Mike Myers phoned me up and sent me the copy and said, you know, will you make sure Freddie hears it? You know, could you? And I said, yeah. So I took it round to him, and Freddie loved it. He laughed and thought it was great. And he went, actually, what he said was slightly unprintable, but you can bleep it if you like. he said, you know, we had a strange thing about America, because America's where we grew up, you know, and it really made us as a group. All that touring, we used to tour every year about 9 months, and most of it was in the States in those early days. So it really formed us as a band, and we absolutely had a love affair with America. There came a point when it all kind of went wrong in America, and we were like the biggest group in the world every place except the States. And I don't need to go into it, you know, the reasons or whatever. It doesn't really matter. But it was very difficult for us to sort of get back, and there's a whole kind of gap in Queen history if you view it from America. And Freddie was very aware of that, and we never really came back and toured the way we should have done. You know, every place else in the world we played football stadiums, but it never happened in the States. And Freddie, when I played him this thing, said... he said, you know, it might do for us what nothing else would do. And he was dead right. You know, it's amazing that even the fact that Freddie died didn't make that much of a difference. But the fact that Wayne's World put it in their film did make a difference. And I suppose the quote that I'm steering clear of is that Freddie at one point said to me, you know, I suppose I'll have to die before we ever get big in America again. And it's a strange quote, but it sort of came true in a very strange way. But Wayne's World was the vehicle through which young people discovered Queen, you know, a whole new set of young people. And it was great for us, you know, and I guess still is.
Have you heard the Muppets version of Bohemian Rhapsody?
Of course, yeah.
It's really fun. Can I play that for our listeners?
Yeah, you can. Well, we had to have heard it because it's us on the record. You know, they asked us if they could do it, and they said, look, we can sing this and we can perform it, but we can't really play it, so can we use your actual track? So
Generally,
we don't let anybody do that. But in this case, because it's the venerable Muppets, we said, yes, we'll do that with you. So, yes, we produced it with them.
It's so much fun. So look, here's part of it.
I see a little silhouette of a clam. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening.
Me, 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 me.
Galileo,
me, 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 me.
Galileo,
me,
Galileo,
me, me, me,
Figaro.
I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, spared in his life from this
monstrosity. Nom, nom.
Easy come, easy go. Will you let me go?
Ma-na-ma-na.
Let me throw.
Ma-na-ma-na.
They will not let you throw.
Let me blow.
Ma-na-ma-na.
They will not let you blow.
Let me jump.
Do not like your jokes.
Let me jump.
Do not like your jokes.
Let me jump.
No, 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 no.
It's Bernigini, Bernigini.
Mamma mia, let me go.
That's the Muppets version of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. We'll talk more with Queen's lead guitarist, Brian May, after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Brian May, a co-founder and the lead guitarist of the band Queen. So let me ask you about the name of the band Queen. How did you feel about giving it that name? Freddie Mercury was either gay or bisexual. I'm not sure how he would have described himself, but he didn't really talk about that
to my
knowledge.
He would have said, "I'm gay as a daffodil, darling."
Would he have said that?
He did say that.
Would he have said that in public?
He did say that in public. Freddie was not one to mince his words.
the name of the band.
How do I feel about it? Oh, well, Terry, this is
also knowing,
you know,
and I guess
like,
this is
such a long way, you know.
But this is also the real, like, there's so many homophobic hard rock fans there were in the 70s and 80s.
How do they feel about Freddie? Well, you know, it's strange. I think it was a sort of an undiscussed thing for such a long time, you know. And really, you know, the truth of the matter is nobody should care. Why should anybody care what sort of sexual persuasion people have? You know, he never hid the fact that he was turned on by men instead of by women. But strange enough, I don't think it was always the case, because I used to, you know, in the early days, we used to share rooms. So I know who Freddie slept with in the early days, and they weren't men. But I think it sort of gradually changed, and I have no idea how these things work. But it wasn't really anybody's business but his. But I remember doing a promo tour for this song that we did, which was called I Want to Break Free. Now, we made a video for that, which was a pastiche of an English soap called Coronation Street, and we dressed up as the characters in that soap, and they were female characters. So we're dressing up as girls, as women, and we had a fantastic laugh doing it. It was hilarious to do it. And all around the world, people laughed, and they got the joke, and they sort of understood it. I remember being on the promo tour in the Midwest of America, and people's faces turning ashen, and they would say, "No, we can't play this. We can't possibly play this. You know, it looks homosexual." And I went, "So?" But it was a huge deal, and I know that it really damaged our sort of whole relationship with certainly radio in this country, and probably the public as
really?
Well. And that's probably one of the reasons why this sort of hole developed between us and the States, which was really a tragedy, because so many of our hits would have fitted very well into the life of the States, but we didn't really get back in there until Show Must Go On and These Are the Days of Our Lives. And even those weren't the hits that they were around the rest of the world. These were some number one records around every civilized country.
Let me get to some more recent developments in your life. Just a few years ago, you got your PhD in a subject that you had been pursuing before Queen, and that's astrophysics. You have an astrophysics
That's right.
book that you co-wrote recently. And
it's called Bang, The Complete History of the Universe.
So it's interesting for me to think about you going back to the university after you'd become such a star. Of course, when you're getting your PhD, it's not like you're sitting in a large lecture class with people, but...
Basically it is, you know. Yeah, I didn't do that many lectures, but basically you're abandoning your status outside and you're going back and you're being a student. It was tough. You're having to be very much subservient to the system again, you know, and you forget how hard that is after you've left school and university, you know, to go back into that system where you're constantly judged and you're assessed as you go along, and you do a piece of work which you're proud of, and then somebody goes, "Well, yeah, but can you go back and do it again and do this and this and this?" It was tough, I'd say. But I didn't want to be treated any different from any other student. I wanted this PhD to be real, and it was. You know, they didn't make it easy on me, and I never wanted that. But it was worth it. I'm happy that I got the PhD.
You wrote your thesis on a survey of radical velocities in the zodiacal dust cloud. I don't really know what any of that means.
It's a survey of radial velocities in the zodiacal.
Oh, radial. I wrote it as radical velocities. I still don't know what it means.
It could be radical.
wait, can you give a very layperson's description of what you were studying in that? Of what you were?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
It's a study of dust. As simple as that. It's dust, in this case, in the solar system. So we're actually surrounded by it. The Earth moves through a cloud of dust constantly, and a lot of it comes down to Earth. And my experiment was to try and find out the motions of that dust, trying to figure out where it's going, what it's doing, where it came from, and what it means in terms of the creation of the solar system. Now, to be honest, it was quite a It became something which people moved on from. It became a bit of a backwater in the 30 years in which I was absent from the subject, because people were into really cosmology, the larger scale study of the universe, and our little local solar system was not so interesting for many people. But luckily for me, about the time that I returned to it, we were discovering exoplanets. That's planets in other solar systems, in orbit around other suns. So it was discovered at that time that they too had dust clouds. So if we're going to study dust, why don't we study the dust on our own doorstep in our own solar system? So my subject became quite trendy again, quite important for people. The way I studied them was through Doppler shifts. And a Doppler shift is a shift of frequency that you experience due to motion. The best analogy you can give is a police siren. If you're listening to a police car coming towards you, it goes dee 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 dee. But as it goes past you, it goes dee 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 dee. It goes down. And that's
true,
a Doppler shift. Yeah, that's because the waves are stretching out as this police car passes you, and it changes from coming towards you to going away from you. Now the same kind of thing happens with light. So I was looking at Doppler shifts in light due to the motions of the dust.
So,
and from that, you can infer how they're moving.
So what were the larger implications of what you were looking at?
Ha-ha, it's a good question. The larger implications are, where did it come from, and was it part of the creation of the universe, or is it being created now?
The dust?
The dust, mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, all of the above is true, really. You know, a certain amount of dust is created in every event in the universe, and particularly in supernovae, a lot of dust is put out. And we, human beings, and all animals, and all plants, and everything on the earth, are made of the dust that has come out of supernovae. Now, that's not something that I discovered, but that's a fact. So when Joni Mitchell said, "We are stardust, we are golden," mm-hmm. She was right. We are stardust. And I find that quite an amazing thing to think about. The material of our body did come from the insides of stars. It was made in the insides of stars.
Well, Brian May, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you. It's
really
a pleasure, Terry.
I really appreciate it. Brian May, astrophysicist and lead guitarist of the band Queen, recorded last August. Our week-long retrospective of some of our most entertaining interviews of the year continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers today are Kevin Griffin and Joyce Lieberman. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.